It's a great pleasure for me to introduce Timo Hämäläinen to you all. Timo is a strategic fellow at CITRA, which is the Swedish Innovation Fund.
Finnish.
Sorry, I'm in the wrong country. Let me start again. Sorry, the Finnish Innovation Fund. When I was reading one of CITRA's papers in preparation for this, I thought I'd better find out a bit about what Timo does. And the paper is entitled "The Transformation of the Finnish Innovation System, a Network Approach," is the name of the paper. First of all, I was impressed that there was an innovation system. I liked that a lot. Secondly, I was impressed that here were a group of people who were thinking about how to transform the innovation system. And then thirdly, they're having a network approach to trying to do that. I said, well, there's a small country in the north of Europe who's transforming the innovation system. That would be a good idea for Scotland. And a quote from that paper, it says, "The challenge facing Finnish society is systemic in nature." The challenge facing Finnish society is systemic in nature. The different parts of society must find a sustainable path together. That to me speaks volumes about the kind of work that CITRA is trying to do and the kind of questions that they are asking, all of which, as I understand it, is funded or is under the aegis of the Finnish Parliament, which is an important issue. And what Timo's going to speak to us about tonight is something he calls the silent transformation of well-being.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you all. This is my second time in Scotland. I was here 2 weeks ago. I seem to be a regular visitor by this. I was in Edinburgh 2 weeks ago. I must say that both cities are very nice. I wish I had more time. I have to leave tomorrow, but maybe next time I come here on a leisure time. I want to argue in my presentation that we should rethink our concept of well-being and that our understanding of well-being needs to be updated. I start by defining or describing the transformation that is taking place with the different determinants of well-being. And I will argue that one of the key changes is that we've come to a situation or stage in the development of our societies where we are not only facing deprivation issues in some parts of our society, but we increasingly, majority of people, we're facing problems of choice, which have to do with the increasing choice and alternatives that we have in our lives, which we have difficulties in managing. And this increased choice is putting growing pressure on our mental well-being and the coherence of our mind. And these then get reflected as a new challenge to our well-being. I will then argue that two of the key features of this new perspective to well-being is that there's increasing short-termism and perhaps selfishness in our decision-making. And that creates new kinds of problems.
Excuse me, we're going to have to use it.
So, I'll make an argument that short-termism and selfishness in our decision-making create societal problems besides their impact on our individual well-being. I will then use the law of requisite variety to move towards the policy implications of my speech. Some ideas about how we can perhaps help the relationship between well-being and economic competitiveness, which is often seen to be contradictory. But I will make the argument that they are actually consistent, especially if you start from well-being. You will also be able to create a competitive economy. And finally, I will argue for a vision that begins from an improved understanding of well-being, and which would be more sustainable, and where the economy and the welfare state would be instruments for well-being, and they would not be goals themselves, like they often are. So, lots of stuff I have here on the agenda. I try to manage 45 minutes. Let me start by a big picture of the current transformation. The technologies and economic structures have been going through a major transformation already for some 20 years or so. And the new information technologies, obviously, are one of the key drivers of this transformation. But we also see globalization and the expansion of markets and business activities. The value-adding chains of corporations are spreading around the globe. At the same time, we see increasing specialization of these value-adding activities of firms, and also increasing differentiation of markets. And I would argue that this increasing specialization of both economy and society are very important factors, also for our own individual well-being. But I'll come back to that later. Our economies and societies are also increasingly knowledge intensive, and as Andrew referred here already, we're living in an increasingly networked society. Now, this has been going on for about 20 years already, but the rest of the society has not really adjusted to this. So we're seeing an increasing mismatch between the technological and economic realities on the one hand, and the social and institutional structures of the society on the other hand. And these, in a way, subsystems of the society which still struggle and try to adjust range all the way from our everyday life and shared mental frames and values and norms to the more concrete laws and regulations, the policies that governments pursue, and public sector organizations. All of these areas, I would argue, will have to go through major changes before we can reach sustainable balance again between the different systems, subsystems of society. And I would also argue that the current economic crisis is a result of this increasing mismatch within our societies. And I don't think, personally, that we are on a sustainable basis with our economies before we solve these structural challenges that are shown here at the bottom of the slide. Now, if we then think about the policy discussions that go on in our societies, they seem to evolve around two subsystems of the society, one being the economy and the other the welfare state. Now, both of these have their own components. Part of the policymakers and researchers are arguing for the need to maintain the competitiveness of the economy, the efficiency, the productivity, the growth, and all these issues. Then we tend to have another group of policymakers and researchers and intellectuals who are proponents of the welfare state and are worried about the current transformation of our societies and whether we can maintain the public sector services, whether we can have enough tax revenue to finance them, and so on. Very often these two parties don't really talk to each other very well. They use different languages and they seem to be more or less in conflict. But neither of these groups really talks much about the nature of well-being, which should be the ultimate goal of their activities. It seems that it's in a way way assumed that we understand well-being well enough so that we don't have a golf club. We can focus on either the quality of the welfare table or the other instruments of creating well-being. But well-being in itself is not a problem. So we can leave that aside. But I would argue, and I've spent the past 4 or 5 years studying this issue, that if you start scratching the surface of what well-being is, you very quickly come to the conclusion that it's really difficult to understand as a whole. And in fact, we've had expert groups in CITRA, the first one in 2006, and then later another group, that were trying to understand well-being, and so come up with a holistic framework. And their conclusion was that really we don't have a good frame to understand well-being as a whole. So it's, in a way, it's both a policy challenge to understand it, but it's also a research challenge. To bring all these different streams of well-being, knowledge, and research together, we have lots of partial understanding and partial perspectives to it, but not a policy one. So based on this, I see that my graph has been squeezed. Based on these discussions that we've had in Finland, we came up with a sort of a straw man model of well-being. And this graph is my own sort of further work on that. And I've tried to include here the sort of main components of well-being, if that is possible. This is work in progress, so it might change in the future. But the idea is that the subjective well-being of people is determined by how well their different needs are being satisfied. And as you can see, I have Maslowian needs there at the bottom, which are obviously still important. But then I've added two other groups of needs. Meaningfulness of life, which is also very important for people. And then mental preparedness, which is less talked about, but also very, very important for people in today's increasingly complex and uncertain world. And these needs are being satisfied through everyday activities and roles that we take in our lives. So we are workers, we are consumers, we are family members, we are relatives, we are friends, hobbies, citizens, and we combine all these different roles daily in our lives. And we act based on various resources and capabilities that are available to us, ranging from income to knowledge, physical, mental health, social relationships, available information, time, political power, natural resources. And all this takes place in a wider environment, which either puts constraints to our daily activities or supports them. Natural environment, infrastructure, technologies, organizational arrangements, and so on. And the interesting thing is that if we look over time how societies have changed, and Finland is a good laboratory because Finland has changed so rapidly, being an agricultural country in the early 1950s, and then rapidly industrializing and now becoming a service society. But I assume that a little bit similar development has taken place in recent history, that there's been major changes in each of these determinants of well-being. So when I analyze the changes that have taken place with regard to each of these determinants of well-being in Finland, the conclusion was that every one of them had changed considerably in the past 30 years or so. So the basic needs have been satisfied fairly well due to the increasing influence of development of society. I would argue that the higher Maslowian needs, which are more social-like in their nature, they love and belonging, self-social esteem, self-actualization,
they seem to be more prominent perhaps than in the past when we had scarcities of AIs. Also, these more mental needs, meaningfulness and mental coherence seem to have become more important in recent years. Now, if we talk about the everyday activities, I would say that in a knowledge economy, knowledge society, increasingly market-driven society, the roles of worker and consumer have become more prominent than in the past. And many of these social relationships, social roles, are under pressure, and we have less time for them. In terms of capabilities, the situation in Finland, at least, is that we have a lot of or the capabilities have become better over time. We have more wealth, more income, better physical health. Social capital, I'm not so sure. In the past, we used to have more time for our relatives and friends than nowadays. But overall, I would say that the resources and capabilities are also better at the moment than 30 years ago. And if you go through the environment of our daily lives, nearly all of them have changed considerably. So we are in a new world now. And I would argue that the old frames of well-being are not very good anymore. We should have an updated version of our understanding of well-being. And the key change, I think, with regard to well-being is that we do have increased resources and capabilities. And our basic needs have been fairly well met. We do have groups in our societies that are still suffering from deprivation, and we shouldn't forget about that. But for the majority of people, basic needs are fairly well met. In the early 1960s in Finland, for example, the main problems with well-being were still material scarcity, basically. And we had a very prominent scholar in Finland who analyzed the situation in the turn of the 60s, 1960s or early 1960s, and he said that the key problem in this poor Finland today, in terms of well-being, is to increase our material wealth, because so many of our well-being problems at that time were stemming from the scarcity of material resources. But he also said that once we have solved these material problems, probably in 2100, then other things will become important in our well-being. But I would argue that time has come now, and other things have become also important. We should take them into account. There is more personal and resource mobility, more freedoms to make individual choices about our lives. There is stronger market supply and marketing pressure affecting our lives. And we seem to be increasingly harried in our lives. But there's also increased uncertainty due to the current transformation of our societies and increasing complexity of our lives. So many things have changed. Now, this creates new types of problems and challenges for us. It makes decision-making more difficult. We have more uncertainty in our lives. We have an information overload. We have spillovers, or we don't always know if we make a certain choice what kinds of effects it will have on others' well-being, because the world is so complex, and if we buy something here now, it may have an effect on some South American farmers' lives, for example. We don't know. Life is so complex. We have less powerful norms to guide our choices. today, this post-learning world, we can more or less choose what norms we want to obey if we don't break the law. So even that poses less of a constraint to our decision making. There is growing individualism in our societies, and related to that also growing selfishness. The markets are really putting pressure on our behavior, and the marketers are very powerful. They have a very powerful impact on our decision making. There is also increasing short-termism in our decision making, and there are fresh research arguing that procrastination is very common and increasingly common in our decision making. And we seem to have less loyalty in our social relationships. Here are two books which deal with these changes if you are interested. Now, if we look at our daily lives, how do these changes affect our daily lives? Well, we tend to engage in many different kinds of activities, both in our working lives and in our leisure time. Because we have the opportunity now. We have those increased resources. We have those increased freedoms. And the market economy is offering us increased choice. And all the activities that we engage in, we think will improve our well-being, otherwise we wouldn't do that. But what we perhaps don't often think is the whole portfolio of activities that we engage in. And we tend to do many things, but we only have a fixed amount of time and fixed mental assets. And those two fixed resources start to create problems when we engage in an increased number of activities. And now these different activities, they might be synergistic so that they support each other. Your hobbies, for example, could be such that they help you in your work. Or they might be contradictory when you have difficulties in combining two activities into your life. Nearly all of these activities have different purposes. They involve different kinds of practices, which take place in different contexts. They are all languages and norms. So, holding this whole portfolio of activities together is a challenge. And, I mean, I've spent 4 or 5 years studying these issues, and I still have difficulty managing my life. So I can imagine that people who are even aware of the situation have perhaps even more problems. But I would argue that all of us more or less have these kinds of problems. Especially people in their busiest years with, you know, with career and children and all the rest of it. But also the younger generation who have perhaps less experience and less less developed brain think about all these activities and how to manage their lives. Now, this problem of choice has an impact on our needs. The individualism and selfishness and short-termism have a negative impact on the higher custodial needs, not of belonging, social esteem, and self-actualization. So they are under pressure. The individualism, selfishness, market pressures, and the specialization and complexity of our lives have a negative impact on the purpose and the meaning of our lives. And the same story applies to the mental coherence. Increasing uncertainty, complexity, decision-making problems, short-termism, competing loyalties, all of these put pressure on our mental coherence. it's not a positive story for Belgium. Now there is an interesting framework by Israeli American legal sociologist Aaron Handel. He studied factors that affect people's health, and he came up with this theory of sense of coherence, which included these three items: comprehensibility, manageability, and meaningfulness of our lives. And he could show that people who comprehend what is going on in their living environment, who can expect what is going to happen next, who can manage their everyday lives, and who have some meaningful purpose in their lives, those people fall ill less frequently than people who have problems with these three items. And the interesting thing is that if you look at these three factors in this current transformation of our societies, each one of them is an oppression. And Antonovsky's framework is not only a theory that explains health, but also explains quality of life and well-being. So one could make the argument that the current transformation of our societies and this problem of choice is having a negative impact on our well-being. Two Finnish researchers have gone through all the empirical work on Antonovsky's theory, and this is their conclusion, that there's a clear relationship between the degree of sense of coherence that people have and their well-being. Antonovsky saw health as a continuum, not as a dichotomy, which would say that you are either sick or you are healthy. He saw that you are living on a continuum where, in the other end, you are more or less totally healthy, and in the other end, you are very sick or dead. And basically, we sort of go back and forth in this continuum. And in the middle of that continuum, you could say there's a gray area where you're not very well, but you're not still ill. And I think we can all, we have experience with this kind of thing. Sometimes we are, you know, we have bad food and we are really sick. But sometimes we feel a little bit bad, but we're sort of hovering there, like that, are we getting sick or are we not? Then we are in this gray area. And now what these pressures from sense of coherence do, I think, is they are pushing us towards the illness end of that continuum. And especially the increased demands of our working life are doing that. In Finland we have, well, I have a graph actually, I will not speak about that yet, but I'll show you a graph of what's happening in Finland in terms of sickness pensions. But there is this other pressure. By the way, that dashed line there is the line beyond which you cannot anymore say the working life. And I would argue that these mental pressures of today's world are pushing people towards this illness and incapacity to work. Now, the working life is doing the opposite. It's pushing this frontier or this threshold of not being able to work anymore towards this healthy end. People with even slight mental problems have severe problems in doing their job in a knowledge economy. In the past, when work was more physical and not so mental, people with slight mental problems could still do their job. But if you're a knowledge worker, these mental problems become very serious. So this might explain why we have these kinds of trends in our labor force. We have increased number, at least in Finland, we have an increased number of people taking these sickness leaves and even ending up to sickness pension due to depression. There is still debate going on in my country about whether the actual number of people suffering from mental health problems is increasing or not. There are prominent professors who say that mental health problems have not increased, but their most recent data is from the year 2000. We haven't had a comprehensive survey of things after that. There's another group of prominent scholars who say that, well, you should look at the scattered evidence that we have from the new millennium. And we have lots of studies that show that different groups of things, their mental health has deteriorated in the past 10 years or so. So the debate goes on, but there's a lot of both anecdotal evidence and these kinds of graphs which show that something negative is going on. Now, I'm turning to the two key decision-making problems that I think are creating also social problems in our societies: short-termism and selfishness. Let's start with the short-termism. Now, psychological research says that people are myopic in their decision making. We tend to favor instant gratification and procrastination over long-term interests. We tend to have particular problems in decision making if our decisions have well-being impacts long into the future, and if our living environments are changing rapidly, and currently they are changing rapidly. Now, when you combine this with the fact that we have increased resources and capabilities, and that we have less stringent behavioral norms, and we have increased market supply surrounding us, and we want to use these new capabilities and freedoms with this fixed resource time, it means that we engage in multiple activities, but we don't really have that much time for each of them. So all this explains why we tend to be short-term oriented, increasingly short-term oriented. That means that we are crowding our lives activities, suffering from hurry, short-termism, procrastination, and decreasing commitment and loyalty. So we always think that the other activity might be even better than what we're doing now. So we're jumping from activity to other activity. Just one example from this short-termism and how the instant gratification wins over the longer-term. This is data about growing obesity in Finland. I mean, there must be other equally good graphs, but I picked this one because it's a fairly comprehensive set of data. Things, army service. So these are youngsters who go to army. In Finland we have a compulsory army. Maybe some 10% of the young men do civil service, but most of them go to army. They are about 19, 20 years of age. And that's what happened to their weight in the recent years, which I think is, in a way, it's a good proxy for how this kind of instant gratification in terms of exercise and eating has changed. And this is their Uber test results. So how long they've been running 12 minutes. read the, this Piers Diehl's book, and it's very, very good. Now, selfishness. Well, this trend of individualism has been very prominent for a long time already, and it's feeding into this selfishness. The other thing is that, that those cultural norms that that made people take other people's interests into account are not having so powerful effect anymore, because we can pick and choose the norms that we want to obey more than in the past. We also have growing difficulties in understanding the full consequences of our actions because of this specialization and complexity of our societies. And as I mentioned earlier, we are increasingly influenced by market forces, and the idea there is that you can be selfish. It's not the problem, because the invisible hand will take care of the public. But that is not the case, of course. Here's another graph about the selfishness of things in traffic. Now, data about selfishness is really difficult to come by, so I don't have other graphs than this. But I think people are perhaps I would say difficult to language in this respect, but basically when you drive a car, especially if you don't have your spouse beside you, I think you're quite natural. You behave as you would in a natural, unconstrained situation. Now, you can see the trend there. Selfish driving habits have become more common, and neglect of traffic rules also. Now, I must say that the number of cars on the roads in Finland has increased during this time period. So that might explain some of this. But on the other hand, you can ask that, okay, if roads have become more congested, should we still behave in a decent and unselfish manner? I've lived in Finland during this period, and I think the traffic has become nastier, and people behave selfish in a way, and it really bothers me. And I'm glad I found this graph, because it sort of shows that I'm on the right track. Now, what's the problem with this short-termism and selfishness from the society's point of view? Well, each individual decision that we make may involve small negative impacts, either on our own well-being in the long term or others' well-being. I've sometimes called these micro-externalities. Now, once we make these decisions that involve these small negative impacts on our own well-being over and over again, they start to accumulate. At some point, they become a major problem. Take the example of eating. If you eat unhealthy once a month, it's probably not a problem. If you do that every week or several times a week, it starts to accumulate, and you might end up with extra weight or massive problems. Same with decisions that involve negative impacts, small negative impacts on others' well-being. These kinds of problems, these kinds of decisions tend to accumulate in larger crops. For example, if you, like I do, I drive my car along to work every morning. I shouldn't, because I can take a bus, but I do, because it's easier and I'm always in a hurry, and you know, the usual story. About in the midway of my drive to work, I always end up in a traffic jam, because there's about 1,000 other drivers like me who do the car by themselves, and they end up in this one part of the highway where the traffic is crawling. So it wouldn't be a problem if only I did that, but when hundreds and thousands of people do the same decision that involves this little extra negative impact, it's huge, and it becomes a social problem. And I should have some examples here. Our invention is unhealthy eating habits, which accumulate over time. Alcohol, tobacco, drugs use. There again, usually if you do it, you know, very rarely, it's not that big of a problem, but then when you do it all over again, it starts to have an impact. Overconsumption accumulates into over-indebtedness. Then if you continuously choose to work long hours and you have spouse and children at home, at some point it starts to have an impact. And it may take 10, 15 years before you see the full impact of your choices. But if you do that all over again, it will have an impact. Postpone method of having children, other examples. Now you can draw this kind of graph, and you can make the argument that short-term and self-interest are very prominent in today's society. However, in the long term, many of these lifestyles create new types of life management problems. And then, on the other hand, selfish choices create well-being problems at the societal level, and then, of course, the environmental problems are the best example of situations where you have both the long-term impact and you have the accumulation in large crowds. So these are not insignificant problems. They are very important ones. But we do not, in a way, take them into account in our daily decision making. So coming back to the this graph, how could we then improve our well-being? Here I would like to use Stafford Beer's viable system model to move toward the policy conclusions of my speech. He argued that the environments of organizations have become so complex that hierarchical organizations have difficulties in dealing with it, and that one needs to decentralize decision making in order to cope with this increasingly complex world. And I would argue that his observations apply to our individuals and our own well-being, so their well-being. He also his viable system model was meant to solve this problem of increased complexity by decentralization that still takes care of the totality of activities. Now you can think about our own activities in our everyday life. So it's said that the viable system always includes the activities, some coordination mechanisms, some control mechanisms, some intelligence to the environment, and then some direction, purpose towards which we aim. Now, if we apply this framework to our individual lives, we can say that our life consists of many activities, these subsystems in this framework. And each of these activities adds some value to our lives. So each one of them is as such. But they need to be somehow coordinated. If the set of activities and roles that we have in our daily lives not somehow coordinated and controlled, we have a mess and our well-being suffers. So it's important to pay attention to this coordination of our daily activities and how we control that whole portfolio of our activities. It's also important to understand what's going on in the world around us. And here we have major challenges because the world is changing so rapidly. And if we only look at the news of the past few months, so many unexpected things have happened that it's no wonder that we are puzzled. But trying to understand what's going on in the world around us and what is our role in that world is very important to us. And I think many of us, including me, are now sort of a little bit suffering from not understanding where the world is going. But it would be important to have that kind of sense. And then this meaningful purpose issue is very important for our well-being too. So we have to pay attention to these issues in our own lives. And if I take another theory here, it's a little bit maybe too much theory, but this is important for those conclusions. This actually has an important law that can be also used to analyze our own lives. It's a law of requisite variety. And what Ashby said was that if you have a certain degree of variety or complexity in your environment, you have to be able to match that with governance arrangements that are of equal variety. If you try to govern complex activities with very simple structures, you will not be very successful. Big uncertainty and problems. So if the world becomes more complex, you will somehow have to increase the capacity to govern your activities. And if we think about our everyday lives, they have become more complex, but our capacity to respond to this complexity has not increased. He also pointed out that we have a limitation that human beings can only control so much. And I would argue that this is a very important fact in our well-being at the moment, that we are faced with increasing uncertainty, increasing complexity, and we cannot really deal very well with that complexity. We're facing an overwhelming variety of life options. But we have a limited cognitive capacity and fixed amount of time at our use. And this creates a problem in our lives. So what could we do to this situation? Now, according to this law of requisite variety, there are two options. Either you reduce the variety and complexity of the world that you have to face, or you somehow try to increase your capacity to deal with it. Let's take the first, the reducing of variety first. So what could we do in our individual lives to reduce the variety and complexity we have today? Well, we could be more selective in what we commit in. We don't have to engage in every activity that sounds interesting and good as such. Because we have so many other commitments, we have to think about the whole life and all the activities that we engage in. And once we make those choices, we should think about our own personal strengths. It's better to engage in activities where you have strengths and which you can manage with your own capabilities. You can also think about the compatibility of the different activities that you engage in. If they support each other, it's easier to manage than if they put the contradictory demands on your capabilities. Now, there are some examples of how some people have, or what you can think about when you some people have started to downshift. Well, this is not an option for many of us, but some people have clearly done this to make their lives more balanced. You can think about the activities where you have these flow experiences or where you really enjoy your life. Those, at least, I think you would like to have more in the future. If you have some higher purpose, those activities that work for that purpose are obvious candidates to be included in your portfolio, so to say. And then work and life balance is an issue that has been discussed a lot. So you might want to think about how to maintain that balance. The other way to reduce variance in your activities is outsource them outsource some of the activities which you think are not that important to your well-being, if that's possible. I mean, that might cost too much money, so that you can't do that. For example, in Finland, we are well known to be a self-service society. You know, this self-service idea comes together with the welfare state, because welfare state means that taxes are usually quite high, which means that you cannot. Many of the services that can operate in countries where taxes are lower are not available in Finland. So we have a lot of self-service in Finland because costs are high. On the other hand, once the government introduced the tax relief for services that were oriented to households in Finland, it was a great success. There was a huge demand for those kinds of services. So people really wanted to give some of the domestic work to service companies, have more time for their more valuable activities and the activities that they really thought were important for their well-being. So if you can do that, if you can outsource some of the activities that are not so important to you, then that's a good idea. Then we can try to build coherent living environments. And this means that once we think about our living environments and we, for example, our built environment, we'd like to create environments which do not create dissonance to our minds, rather than in a way support our the mental healing of our brains and in a way consistent with this mental occurrence. There's interesting research about, for example, the impact of nature and built environment on well-being that is relevant here. But also these popular trends of cocooning and retro fashions and brands, I think they also reflect people's need for an environment that does not create uncertainty and dissonance in their minds. They want to have sort of a safe nests at home, and the retro fashion is something which is familiar to them in a way which is not causing stress in their minds, quite the contrary. Technology could be more human-centric, easy to use. I think a part of the success of these iPads and iPhones and so on have to do with this. I mean, I have a Nokia phone in my pocket because I work for the government, but public sector in Finland, and Nokia is from Finland, so we tend to have Nokia phones. But I must say that iPhone is probably at least as easy to use as Nokia phone. And then we have also a regulation of cultural norms which can be either constraining our daily life or they can support it. We could have more customized services that would take our unique situations into account better than mass produced services. In welfare states, we often tend to have mass produced services. And I think one of the future trends is that even public services are moving towards more customized life. Working life can be supportive of life balance, or it can make shifting balance in our lives very difficult. Media has an important role too. Very often it provides very sort of splintered information and does not provide very much deep knowledge about the issues, and hence it doesn't perhaps help us much to understand the world around us in any sort of more comprehensive way. But it could. Then we have these other features like mindfulness training, which is about focusing on the current activities, not thinking about what I did in the past or what I should do in the future, but focusing on current activities. That might also help some people, because then you don't consider all of the activities, the agenda at the same time. Some people turn to fundamentalism in these times. That gives you a very clear and simple picture of the world, but might lead to other type of problems. So there are various ways of trying to reduce the variety and choice in our lives. Then you can also try to improve the capacity to deal with these environments. There are various ways of trying to improve our coordination and control capacities. We use these PDAs every day, calendars. We can also have peer support groups that help us with difficult challenges. And of course, we have to take care of our day-to-day health and rest. Then in terms of intelligence, comprehensibility dimension, there we need new types of skills. There's been discussion about, for example, the synthesizing skills becoming more important in today's world. We have lots of narrow analytical knowledge, but today's complex world requires broad-based understanding of what is going on, how different things relate to each other, and that poses new challenges to our education system. Some people also use meditation to clear up their minds and to give room and time for the brain to work through all these complexities. I've read some brain research which says that our unconscious has much more capability to deal with complex problem solving than our conscious mind. So giving enough time for our mind to work in the unconscious side is important. Meditation probably is one way of doing it. And then we have the question of purpose and direction. And there, religions might offer some people with it. Basically serving others is the single most important way of gaining meaning in one's life. Not only looking at one's own interests, but being at the service of others or of the society. Maureen O'Hara has written about the possibility of us creating a capability to deal with this increasingly complex world, and that if we manage to create such capability, that would mean that we would have a new transformation of human beings. So it remains to be seen whether we can develop our capabilities in this way. Now, economic competitiveness and well-being are usually very often seen as contradictory, because people see that well-being equals the welfare state, and welfare state equals high taxes, and high taxes equals to more competitiveness. But I think this is not the whole story, and it's not really correct, because well-being is not the same as the welfare state. Now, if one thinks about the competitiveness of high-cost countries like Britain or Finland, we cannot compete on low cost. There are always societies which have lower costs. We have to be able to compete with high value added. And if one thinks about value added, it becomes clear that value stems from the contribution that products and services make to our individual well-being. The better products and services serve our well-being, the more value they provide us. And so if we understood well-being very well, we could create better products and services and also policies that added more value to our lives. And hence, superior well-being knowledge could be a source of competitive advantage for our firms. And we could also create better living environments for the citizens. We could have better policies that are more effective in achieving our goals. And we could build better institutions and living environments. Hence, I think we need to focus on well-being and try to understand it better in today's society and also in the future. And that could provide, I think, a vision for our societies. I think Europe is well positioned to focus on well-being. If we compare the European preference for a good life to the goals of the Asian countries or the goals in America, I think Europe has an edge here. We have good institutions also for well-being, and we can build on this. And I think this would be a nice vision for Europe, that we would set well-being as the number one goal in Europe, and our economy, the public sector, would be back to the position of instruments that work on this well-being.